Shall I start?
Sure.
Okay. So, is this on? I guess it is. So what I want to do today for the last lecture is to do one more example of a proof of quantifier elimination for a given structure. This will be nice because it gives us, we can use a different test for quantifier elimination, so it gives us, get to see what other tests there are and also how we can apply this particular test. It also gives us an example of an expansion of the reals, which is not O-minimal. It does have quantifier elimination, but is not O-minimal, but is still pretty nice, and in some ways fairly close to being O-minimal. So I'm presenting the results of another paper of Lau van den Dries. Which is called the field of reals with a predicate for powers of 2. And this appeared in a manuscript of math in 1985. So the that was clear from the title, the intended interpretation, the structure we want to talk about is the real field, so the reals with the ring structure, the ordered ring structure, plus times 0, 1, less than. And then we want to put in a predicate which tells us whether or not an element is a power of 2. So we want to put in the set 2 to the z. Now putting in that set, of course, immediately gives us a countable discrete set. So it's obviously a structure which is not going to be O-minimal. But what we need to do is to work out how to get, write down first of all the axioms and the language which is going to give us this as our intended interpretation. Then, of course, there will be other models, and then the question is, how do we get the quantifier elimination? So the language that we use, well, first of all, what we do in order to get at, in order to name a subset, is to simply name a predicate, add a predicate, and then say certain properties that that predicate should have. So to the language of ordered rings, we add a predicate, which I'll call S, just S for set. And then what I want to say about it is that enough to try to make it look like 2 to the Z. So first of all, so we'll give some axioms. First of all, I'm going to say that 2 is an element of S, so we put 2 in. And anything which is between 1 and 2 is not in S. So for all x, if x is strictly between 1 and 2, then x is not an element of S. I'll call that one T1. And then we want to say that S is a subgroup of the positive elements of the field and is closed under multiplication. In fact, it's a multiplicate. It's a group, a subgroup under multiplication. So for all x, if x is in S, then x is greater than 0. For all x and for all y, if x is in S and y is in S, then x times y is in S. Every element has an inverse. For all x, there exists a y, such that if x is in S, then y is in S, and x times y equals 1. Okay, so those are the axioms that say it's a multiplicative subgroup of the set of positive elements. I'll call that collection of axioms T2. And then we want to say that the elements of this S are are dense in the whole field in a certain sense. So to be precise, for all x, if x is greater than 0, then there exists a y such that y is an S, and x lies between y and 2y. Let me call that one T3. Okay, so these are the pretty much the axioms that we want to know about S. The issue with them is that when we go down to a substructure, so when we're trying to prove quantifier elimination, remember we go down to a substructure and then we ask whether a formula which is true over in a model over the substructure is true in another model. And the trouble with these is right here, this axiom about, which says that they're, well, this axiom is not going to be true in a substructure necessarily. Right? If I go down to a substructure, I'll have the set S interpreted in that substructure, but I won't know, because this is an existential statement, I won't know that there is some Y in my substructure, which is in S and which acts as a bound for X. So a substructure won't know enough about the set S in order to tell us that whether a formula is true in two different models. So we need to put in a little bit more into the language, basically in order to force this, well, for two reasons, to force this axiom to hold in a substructure, and then we also need to know a little bit more, and so we'll see what that is. So we add to the language two more things. So I'm going to take the language now, I'm going to take my language, and in the notes I called it L2. It's a terrible name, but I couldn't think of a better one, and I guess I'll stick with that terminology. So L2 is this language that I wrote down so far, so it's the language of ordered rings with this predicate S. And in addition, we have a function symbol lambda, a unary function symbol lambda, and a family, a further family of unary predicates, P sub n, for n greater than or equal to 2. And I need to say a little bit more about those predicates in order to say what they're supposed to mean. So for lambda, I want to say that lambda is going to be the function which picks out this element y. All right. So this one says that there is a y which is in the set S and acts as a bound for x. Lambda picks it out. So my fourth axiom, T4, says for all x and for all y, if lambda of x is equal to y, if and only if either x is less than 0, in which case we just put it equal to 0, or x is greater than or equal to 0, and in which case y, which is lambda of x, will be an S, and y will lie between x. X will lie between y and 2y. So lambda, now when I take a substructure, in particular it has to be closed under the function lambda, and so I'll have to have an element which does that bounding. And then I need to say something about these predicates P sub n. So for every n, I have an axiom which says P sub n is those elements of the set S which have an nth root in S. So for all x, P sub n of x will hold, or if it holds, then there exists a y, which is in S, and y to the n equals x. So in the intended interpretation, which is the reals with S interpreted as 2 to the z, then lambda of x is the power of 2, which is just below x, or equal to x, and P sub n is 2 to the nz. I should write that down. In R, with the set S interpreted as 2 to the Z, then T sub N is 2 to the N Z. Okay, so we pick out this further information that we're saying about it. It doesn't hurt to say if and only if, so I'll put it in. Yes, okay. So P sub n of x if and only if x is greater than 0 and...
Yeah. So I mean in the previous one.
In the previous one, didn't I say that? Oh. Do I put 0 in? Okay. So let's push these over. All right. Okay, so then let's see what happens if we take a substructure of a model. So I'll call, let's say, let's write T sub 2 is the theory which has is all of these axioms together. T1 union T5 for all n. And so then if I have a model, them is a model for the theory T sub 2, and A is a substructure of M, then what's true about A will be an ordered integral domain we'll have that A satisfies the axiom T3 because that's why we put in lambda. We'll have that if I look at S, the interpretation of S in A, it'll certainly satisfy these two parts of axiom T2. Won't necessarily have inverses, although it will have inverses. The interpretation of S in A will contain any inverse that is in A. Right? A is only a ring. I don't know that it has inverses, but if those inverses are there, then they'll have to be in S. So S, as interpreted in A, will if closed under multiplication, and I'll just say n inverses that are in A. And if we look at P sub n, how does P sub n get interpreted in A? Well, P sub n is just in A has to be the intersection of P sub n as interpreted in the model with the set A. Okay, that's what it means to be a substructure. And so what that means here is that P sub n will be precisely those elements X in SA, in the set S as interpreted in A, for which there exists a Y in the bigger model, such that y to the n is equal to x. So what this set P sub n does in A is to look up to the model and ask whether the element has an nth root there, because that's just what this intersection is. And also what's true, which maybe I have to think a little bit in order to see that this is true, is that the predicate S as interpreted in A, in fact, has to be precisely the set of lambda of X, such that X ranges over A. And the containment in one direction comes from the definition of lambda. The containment in the other direction comes from this axiom, comes from T1. So there are some things which are not in S. And so if we put in some things which were not lambdas. In fact, we would eventually get a contradiction with T1. So that gives us a little bit more control over what SA actually is. All right, so then the theorem. The theory T2 in the language L2 has elimination of quantifiers. Okay, so for the proof, I want to use yet another test for quantifier elimination, chiefly because it gives me an excuse to write down this test, which is extremely useful and rather elegant. So the theorem, which is a quantifier elimination test. So if I just take any theory T, a language maybe with at least one constant symbol, to get things started. So T as quantifier elimination, if and only if the following property so what the property is, let M be any model of T, a substructure of M, N a saturated model, saturated in the cardinality of M, plus and so we take M, we take a substructure A, we take some other model over here, N, and we suppose that there's an elementary embedding from A to N. So such that there is sigma which goes from A into N, an elementary embedding. So the property is that if I have that set up, then I can extend sigma to an embedding I can adjoin any further element from M and extend sigma to that further element. So for any C, which is in M and not in A, sigma can be extended to an elementary embedding from the structure generated by A, by C over A, into N. Okay, so if I have a theory which has this property, then in fact it has quantifier elimination. I never told you what it means to be saturated. So a model is saturated in a given cardinality if any type, so if any consistent collection of formulae over any set of parameters, which is only that big as the cardinality given, has a realization. Yeah, I should write this down. So my model N is kappa saturated if for any A, a set of parameters in N, and let me write that, that's not a substructure, that's just a subset. For any subset A of N with cardinality at most kappa, any consistent set of formulae over the parameters A is realized in N. So if I take a consistent set of formulae, I can find one element which makes all of them true at the same time, and I can find that element inside of N. That's what it means to be saturated. Okay, so in order to prove quantifier elimination for this particular theory, I want to prove this condition. So let's assume we have M, a model of T2. We have A, a substructure of M. We have N, another model of T2, which is cardinality of M plus saturated. Making it saturated in this cardinality just makes it sure that it's big enough that whenever I take any substructure of M, I can, if I have a type over that substructure, then I can realize it in N. And that's the point of choosing that cardinal. And I'm going to assume I have an embedding from A into N. Well, the first thing I'm going to do is to assume that sigma is the identity, just so I don't have to keep writing it down. So let's assume that A is also a substructure of N. And now I need to take some element, I need to fix C in M without A, and I need to extend, I need to be able to map, I don't have to extend, I, well, I have to extend the identity as an elementary embedding from the structure A, the structure generated by C over A, into N. So what I really need to do is to find, in order for a mapping to be an elementary embedding, what that says is that if I have a formula which C realizes with parameters in A, then there's a formula which this element sigma of C realizes over sigma of A, but that's just A. In other words, what it's saying is that I need to find an element which realizes the same type as C over A. Well, since it's a saturated model, it seems like I don't have to do anything. It seems like, okay, it's a saturated model, so there is one. The trouble is that I take this type of C over A in M, I have to understand what that type means when I interpret it over an N. And it may not be a consistent type over an N because I have different interpretations for the symbols. So the issue is, is this actually a consistent type when I look at it inside of N? So I need to find D and N such that the type of D over N over A, maybe I'm not even sure I want to write this, with the same type, satisfying the same type, as C, as an element of M, realizes over A. So what I have to do in order to, I mean, I could just take all the type, but what I really need to say is, if I take just a partial type, if I know a little bit of information about C, information which I know is going to be consistent in N, does that tell me everything about C over A? In other words, is the structure that C generates over A completely controlled by having just a partial type, which is information about C over A, which is information which I know is consistent when understood in N? So I need to look for what information do I need to know about C, which will then determine the structure of A over C, that information is consistent in N. So find What I want to know is, is the structure of A, A is C, determined by C and by a partial type, and how much of it? Satisfied by C over A. So when we were looking at the quantifier elimination for the reals in the language of ordered rings, the first thing we did was to take a substructure, observe that it's an integral domain, and then observe that in fact we can assume that it's a field and in fact a real closed field, because the structure of the language extends uniquely to the field and then to its real closure. And we want to do the same thing here. So we, what we're really saying is, first of all, suppose I had my C, which is in the quotient field of A, observe that the structure of the language extends uniquely, and then keep on going. So the first thing to consider is that C is actually in the quotient field of A. And to see, does that determine the further pieces of the language? What happens to lambda? What happens to the set S sub A? And what happens to the sets P sub N? So first of all, let's see what happens to lambda in this case. So I have C is equal to some A over B, where A and B are in A, and I might as well assume that A and B are both positive. So in that case, we know that lambda of A is less than or equal to A, which is less than 2 times lambda of A, because that was the definition of lambda, and the same thing for B. Lambda of B is less than or equal to B, is less than 2 times lambda of B. Now, if I divide this inequality, then this actually tells me that 1/2 lambda of A over lambda of B is less than A over B, which is less than 2 times lambda of A over lambda of B. And notice that all of these things, whatever else I do when I extend S to the quotient field of A, it certainly will contain 1/2 and 2. And since lambda of A is in the set S in the sense of A, then lambda of A over lambda of V will have to be in the set S extended to the quotient field. So these things are all in the S in the sense of the quotient field. So I lambda of A over B is determined if A over B is strictly less than lambda of A over lambda of B, then lambda of A over B, remember, lambda of A over B is the element of S which is just below A over B. A over B is less than lambda of A over lambda of B, so I have to pick up this one. So lambda of A over B has to be 1/2 lambda of A over lambda of B, because then this is an element which is less than or equal to A over B, but which 2 times it is greater than A over B. And on the other hand, if A over B is greater than or equal to lambda of A over lambda of B, then lambda of A over B will have to be lambda of A over lambda of V. So in any case, whatever happens, lambda is just determined. It's just, I know exactly what it has to be. So there's no choice in going up to the structure. So, also this gives us that the interpretation of S in the quotient field of A just has to be the quotient of the interpretation. So it was just the set of lambda of A over lambda of B. Actually, I can just write it as a set of A over B, such that A and B are in the interpretation of S in A. And similarly for piece of N interpreted in the sense of the quotient field is again just going to be, I'm going to write this down. I hope nobody calls me on it. A over B, such that A and B are in piece of N in the sense of A. So it's okay to go up to the quotient field. Okay, so then the next thing is to go up to the real closure. So suppose I take C, which is in the real closure of A. Let me call this A tilde, just in case I need a name for it. Now, if C is in the real closure of A, so it satisfies a polynomial with coefficients in A, then, in fact, looking at that polynomial, I can divide out by something in A and realize that then that element is finite, that is bounded by integers. So what we have is that there is some natural number n and some d in A itself such that c to the n over d is finite. Now I'm working in some very large model. I don't know how the integers sit in it. Probably has infinite elements. But since I know that C has to satisfy some polynomial with coefficients in A, then at some point it has to get down to being finite so I can make it equal to zero. Okay, so we might as well assume if C to the n over D is finite, lambda of D is close to D. So we might as well assume that D is equal to lambda of D. Okay, so let's consider, so again, what am I trying to do? I'm trying to make sure that lambda of C is determined by the information I have about C. There's no choice in the way of defining lambda. So I'm trying to find out what lambda of C actually is. Okay, let's consider the set of elements d to the 1 over n, 2 times d to the 1 over n, up to 2 to the n minus 1, d to the 1 over n. Now, these are all elements of the real closed field A tilde. A tilde is a real closed field, so D has an nth root. But I can ask, where in the sense of the big model, M, do these sit in the nth power structure? Right? So D is an element of lambda. So it may, and D to the 1 over N, D may or may not have an nth root, or two times it might have an nth root, or two squared times it might have an nth root. But the axiom T1, which gave us a restriction on what actually was allowed to get into the set S, tells us that at most one of these elements is in S, in the sense of the model M. At most one. But since I also have to get every element bounded by, you know, an element in S or two times an element in S, there also has to be at least one. So in S, as understood in the big model in which we're working, exactly one of these elements is in piece of N understood in M. No, if I look at any element, it doesn't matter that it's the 1 over N, really. Yes, you're right. I need breath. Yes, I'm asking whether these elements have an nth root. So exactly one of them, for the purposes of this particular argument, we might as well assume that it's the first one. So we may assume that, in fact, d to the 1 over n is in p sub n in the sense of m. It doesn't matter if it were any of the others, I could use that instead of d in the as I go on. So then what we've got is that d to the 1 over n is an element of S in the sense of M. Okay, what is this? This condition here says that D to the 1 over D has an nth root in S. And so it has an nth root in S in the sense of M, but it's also in the algebraic closure of A, or the real closure of A, because it's just an nth root. And so in particular, it's in, so D to the 1 over N has to be in S as interpreted in the real closure of A. Okay, so now I've got C to the N over D is finite, and the nth root of D is something which is in my set S, in my predicate S. So let's just look at the element C over D to the 1 over N. All right, so just take the nth root of C to the N over D. Well, since C over D to the 1 over N is finite, in particular, it's bounded by some power of 2, so there is K such that 2 to the K lies between less than or equal to C over D to the 1 over N, which is less than 2 times 2 to the K. So this says that lambda of C, 2 to the K times D to the 1 over N, is in the set S in the sense of A tilde. Has to be. That's what we've chosen it that way. And so lambda of C then just has to be this element. Thus, lambda of C is equal to 2 to the K times D to the 1 over N. So what this is saying is that once I know that C is in the real closure of A, and once I know which of these, you know, I find this element D, and then once I know which of these has an nth root, then that nth root determines what lambda of C is. And if I had said, the one which has an nth root is 2 times D, then that would be okay, I just use 2 times D instead. So the information about which one has an nth root controls what lambda is in the real closure. Okay, so lambda extends uniquely, and then also S will extend uniquely and P sub N as well. So now we'll have to consider the case. Now we might as well assume that our ground substructure is real closed, and then we need to look at C, which is transcendental over that real closed field. So now, assume C is transcendental over A, which is real closed. Okay, so now there are two possibilities, depending on how we how we extend C over A, I can add in this element C, but assume that lambda, I still have lambda of C. So case one is that lambda of C is in S in the sense of A. Maybe I need a little notation. Let me write, just in case I need it, write A prime, the structure generated by C over A. So if I have, if when I adjoin C, I still have lambda of C. So this is really saying that adjoining C, it's finite with respect to A. Right? I already have it bounded by the set S of A. Well, then in fact, if I take any other element of A prime, the same thing will still be true. Lambda will be uniquely defined. So if E is any other element of A prime, E is just a term in C. So then if C is finite over A, then any term in C is also finite over A. So there will be some A in A such that A is E bounds A. A is less than or equal to E less than 2 times A. And so that tells us what lambda should be. So lambda of E is equal to A. And so it's, in particular, it's determined. I don't have any, there's no possibility of interpreting it in different ways. So that also tells us what, there's A there's A in A, there's also A in SA, which is where it needs to be. So that will tell us, once I know lambda, I know SA, and then I also know, similarly, I know, I should know P sub N. I know P sub N because when I make the step of going from A prime up to A, I don't add any new nth roots. So in fact, P sub N won't change. Also, P sub N in the sense of A prime will just have to be the same as P sub N in A. All right, so the harder case is when I do extend SA. So case two is that lambda C is not in S in the sense of A, so I've also increased my set SA. We might as well assume that C is actually equal to lambda C, because if it isn't, I'll do it for lambda C and then go on from there. Okay. So now I have to look at, well, what in that case, we know that the S interpretation of S in A prime is not the same as the interpretation of S in A, so how big can it be? But it can't be too big because we're working inside this, I've taken this field and I've adjoined one transcendental element, so the new field has transcendence degree one, so this subgroup of the multiplicative group, it it also has to have just one generator. So the generator has to be C, which is lambda of C. So since the transcendence degree of A prime over A is equal to 1, the subgroup SA prime must be generated by one element over S as interpreted in A, So that means that S and A prime just has to be A times C to the L, as A ranges over S, the interpretation of S and A, and L, we're just taking all integer powers of C. It's just the group generated by C over A. So SA prime is determined. I don't have any choice. And so also lambda must be determined as well, because why? If I take any term in C, well, I think we have to be able to, all right, getting a little fuzzy here, but all right, so my claim is that then lambda in the sense of A prime is also determined. I just have to pick the nearest element of this set A sub C to the L, which is close to a term in C. I think that actually is clear that it's determined. Okay, so then what about the nth roots? Well, in the case of the nth roots, we have a choice, because just as up here, we said exactly one of the elements of this set are going to actually be in P sub n in the sense of the model. What I have to do is to know for each n which element of this set is going to have an nth root, which element, which possible one of the C, 2 times C, 2 squared times C up to 2 to the n minus 1 times C has an nth root, and that information then determines everything about the set P sub n. But there is a choice there, right? So I can put in different one of those elements into the sets which pick and choose which one has an nth root, and that gives me different models. But information, so this is the partial type. I have some information about C. I have to choose those pieces of information that's consistent. I can realize it in N, and so I'll be able to go on. All right, so what we do is say for each N, take I of N to be the element of from 1 up to N minus 1 such that 2 to the I of N times C is an element, that's a C, that's an element of P sub N in the sense of M, then this sequence of choices then tells me everything about the interpretation of P sub N interpreted in A prime. And then that sequence of choices is consistent in N. And so that finishes the proof. So I'm done.